Yesterday, Keir Starmer gave the speech that was supposed to relaunch his leadership and present his vision for the economy for the next 10 years. It hasn't blown many people away, but did it do the job? I'll be speaking to James Meadway in a moment on that question. Throughout the show, I'll be joined by Dahlia Gabriel. How are you doing, Dahlia?
I'm fucking exhausted, but I am here and I'm alive and I'm going to make it through. I'm okay, just really tired for some reason, but not bad.
I'm on the edge of my seat because people outside keep deciding to have fireworks displays at 8 p.m. on a Friday. So if you hear any explosions in the background, don't worry. We have a jam-packed show for you tonight. As well as talking about that speech, we've got the Supreme Court ruling on Uber, vaccine diplomacy at the G7, a ridiculous new Home Office advert you might have seen on Twitter, the latest on the Grenfell inquiry, and James O'Brien being a dick. So many stories for you tonight, a jam-packed Friday night show. This week saw Starmer deliver what was billed as his most important speech to date. He was supposed to set out his big vision for the next 10 years, what he would do in power. We'll be discussing whether the speech warranted all the hype, but first let's take a look at some of it. So much of the speech was devoted to reiterating the dividing line Starmer has always tried to draw between himself and the government.
That's why a Labour budget would protect families. We would not cut the £20 uplift in universal credit, benefiting 6 million families by £1,000 a year. We'd provide local councils with the funding they need to prevent huge rises in council tax. And we'd end the insult of a pay freeze for our key workers after they've given so much. And a Labour budget would also back British business by extending business rate relief and the VAT cut for hospitality and leisure, by easing the burden of debt that weighs down on so many businesses, and by extending and updating the furlough scheme so that it's better able to help people back into work.
Basic bread and butter stuff. We knew that already, but all fine. He was proposing that there be no cut to universal credit, obviously a good policy, to end the pay freeze for key workers, which the government are planning to implement even after the pandemic, and support for businesses and the furlough scheme. All of this we knew already, but nothing wrong with repeating it. There was a new announcement, though. It was support for something called a British recovery bond.
If I were Prime Minister, I would introduce a new British recovery bond. This could raise billions to invest in local communities, in jobs and in businesses. It could help build the infrastructure of the future, investing in science, in skills, in technology and British manufacturing. It would also provide security for savers and give millions of people a proper stake in Britain's future. This is bold, it's innovative, and it's an example of the active, empowering government I believe is needed if we're going to build a more secure economy.
Now, I'm always against people saying their policy is bold and innovative. I think it's better to show, not tell, and it seems a little bit desperate. I think this is a really innovative policy, by the way. But perhaps it is. You might be wondering what a recovery bond is. I also was when I listened to that speech. In my research afterwards, though, I was delighted when a very familiar name popped up. That's because James Meadway wrote an article a month ago proposing them. So this was in the Times headline, Britain's sourdough savers could kickstart the recovery. The sourdough savers is a reference to the middle class people who managed to save over the course of the pandemic, obviously because they were spending less maybe on transport to work, but also on the usual things you spend your money on, meals out, going to the pub, etc., etc. I'm joined by James Meadway now. Has Keir Starmer nicked your idea?
He's got bits of it. I mean, it's not just me who's raised something like this. The, Margaret Thatcher's favourite think tank back in the day, the Centre for Policy Studies, has also floated the idea of offering a bond to all these people who've saved money over the last year and using that money to invest in, they suggest small businesses. I've suggested local authorities. You can do small businesses as well. You can do worker cooperatives. You can do all sorts of things. So the idea is knocking around. And it's basically because everyone's looking at this massive pile of savings that at least some people, and we've got to be very clear, like experience in the pandemic has been hugely unequal. There's a great set of people that's been absolutely horrendous for, but there's a small group of people relatively better off. I mean, basically sort of middle class, not super rich here, but relatively better off working from home, not furloughed, not spending so much. And they've saved about £120 billion over the last year, which is enormous. And if you were to take that money and put it into parts of the country in particular that are otherwise have problems raising any money for investment, so basically most of the country outside of London, it would make a huge difference. So that's the idea. So you say to these people, instead of having your savings in a bank account, here's a bond, not a very high interest rate, but it doesn't need to be at the minute. It's secure, and that money will go into investing in local infrastructure, improving bus services, new tram system, local businesses, if you like. There's a whole list of things you could be doing with this. So that's the idea behind it. On its own terms, I think it's not a bad thing to do. I don't necessarily think it's what you want as like your absolute, this is the golden policy that we're going to run with. This is going to change things. So yeah, there's a difference in how you pitch these things and where you want it to land.
Of this particular policy, the criticism I saw is, so essentially, to put it in basic terms, this recovery bond or whatever it would be, if I'd managed to save £5,000 throughout the pandemic because I'd bought less avocado on toast, I could buy a bunch of bonds, get 2% interest on them, and the government would be spending that money on investing in the economy. That all sounds well and good. The criticism I've heard is that essentially it's so cheap for the government to borrow from the financial markets that this would be a more expensive way for the government to borrow from its citizens at, say, 2% instead of from the financial markets at 0.1%. And so we would actually be transferring money from the government to the people who did well out of this pandemic. Is that a valid critique?
No, not really. The critical issue with this, and it's not something that the Keir Starmer's speech hammered home, but the bit where this becomes interesting isn't like, let's lend money to the government so it can spend the money. The government has no problems at all raising money at this point in time. I mean, interest rates for the central government, driven by, God, long-term changes in the economy, quantitative easing, all these things, it's incredibly cheap for the government to borrow money and go and spend things. The difficulty is what happens to everybody who isn't the government, and in particular, what happens to you if you're not the government in the rest of the country outside of London and the City of London. If you're a small business in, you know, somewhere in the Northeast, let's say, or actually, like I say, most of the country outside of London, it's really hard still for you to get, you know, reasonably priced long-term investment if you want to expand your business or try and rebuild after the pandemic, right? That's one thing that you find hard to do. If you're a local authority, the government centrally can borrow very, very cheaply. You as a local authority can't. You're under tight control by central government. And that's been a disaster for local authorities. Local governments have been about the hardest hit of any bit of the entire kind of public sector in the last 10 years. They've seen a 40% real term cut in their funding. So they're really stuck and they can't borrow money to invest in their area. They can't do all these things we might want to see happen in the locality because they can't get that cheap funding. But they've got all these people in their local area now with huge amounts sitting in their bank account, not doing very much. So you've got to turn it from that into doing something useful. That's the idea. The really big bit here is potentially you do this in a way that means you're independent of Whitehall. You no longer have to rely on the generosity, in effect, of Rishi Sunak saying, you can now borrow this money cheaply. You can now have some more funding. You've done something in your local area. You're building an independent, autonomous, you know, you're doing something more interesting than what central government can do with that money. That's the exciting part of it. That's the bit. If Labour wanted to pursue that, you're talking about really quite a radical way of thinking about what we're going
to do. But that's not really what they announced. They just announced another way for the government to borrow.
The political bit in this is that they can probably somewhere down the line just go, when if they ever get like, oh, how are you going to pay for all this? They'll just go, yes, recovery bond. It's all there, recovery bond, right? So it's the politics.
I want to talk about the politics more generally because the criticisms of the speech generally came not really because of what there was announced in it, but what it was lacking and that it was kind of full of lots of platitudes. I want to get up the sort of graphic that the Labour Party put out for the speech. So they have a picture of Keir Starmer looking very prime ministerial in front of an estate. And he says, we must seize this moment and go forward to a future that is going to look utterly unlike the past, which is fairly contentless. There were even more platitudes in the questions and answers session. So this was when he was ad-libbing. This was, you know, coming from the heart. Let's look at an exchange between Starmer and Tony Diver from The Telegraph.
On the pandemic, what I said on the very first day I became leader of the Labour Party is we'd be a constructive opposition. We're in a global pandemic, which puts huge strain on any government, and everybody understands the challenges. And what I said we would do was be constructive in the sense that we would support the government where that was the right thing to do. So, for example, on the various restrictions and the lockdowns, we have been fully supportive of the government, even when, in fact, the backbenchers were not so supportive because it was the right thing to do. But we've challenged them where we thought they were getting it wrong in order to try and make sure, above all else, that they got it right the next time around, whether that's testing, protective equipment to the front line. Now, I don't think that's soft. I think that's the national interest. I think the public would say, in a time like this, you back the things that the government is doing right, and you challenge them where you think they're getting it wrong in order that, you know, they improve on that. And I think that's the right, you know, everybody is concerned that we pull through this and pull through it together. That then raises your second point. Where do we go from here? And if anybody wants to understand my thinking and judge it in whatever way they want, I'll hand up my text and they can have a look at it, because what I'm setting out is what I think is the path we need to take for our country for the next 10 years, and making it very clear that we can't go back to business as usual. We can't go back to where we started and say, well, let's try to repair what we had and carry on with the model that we've had from 2010 to 2020. I'm saying we've got to take a different path, and setting out what that different path is for a better, more secure Britain.
The question there was, you know, have you been too soft on the government, supporting them too often? Starmer's response, I supported them when they did the right thing. I criticized them when they did the wrong thing. Then about the vision for the future, I want to move forward, not backwards. Always twirling, twirling, twirling. I mean, it was a lot of word salad. James, do you think I'm being unfair?
Not really, no. I mean, there was some content to the speech, like the actual content, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, because actually Keir Starmer said this all the way through his time as leader, that, you know, he doesn't want to return to austerity. And he had quite a clear argument about how spending cuts are bad and the pandemic has revealed the weaknesses of our public sector as a result of austerity. And, you know, if he was facing George Osborne, if he was going into the 2015 election, this would be brilliant. But he's not. He's going in the 2024 election, and he's facing a Conservative government that has, even before the pandemic, started increasing spending. That's where we are. So he was all set up to fight probably not even the last battle, but the one before, in terms of the content. And he's made it life potentially very easy for the government, because if you're saying, we're going to, you know, your ideological cutters, you're just going to cut things, you're just going to do this, all they have to do is just increase spending ever so slightly, and suddenly, where's your attack line? It's disappeared. So there's a real problem with how this speech, I think, was conceptualised in terms of what Labour thinks it's up against for the next few years. Like, that even if the Tories are actually inclined to cut, because you're going, you're ideologically driven to cut, they just have to point to a few spending increases, and suddenly that attack line's gone, and you're dealing with the old enemy. You're not thinking about the threats and things in the future. So that was kind of the problem with the overall conception of it. It was kind of stuck in an argument that we've had in the past, not the arguments we're going to face. Tories talking about the Green Industrial Revolution. What's Labour's response to that? That's our rhetoric, our language. They're going to implement it. And my guess is it's going to be popular. It's going to create jobs. It's going to look like you're doing something environment. It's going to work for them. How are you going to stop that happening? How are you going to How are you going to stop them profiting from it politically? You know, there wasn't much concept of this. It was weak in that sense.
The left have been critical of Starmer for a while. That's nothing new. What is kind of new is that journalists seem to have turned against him, and not just left-wing journalists, you know, mainstream journalists. They seem to have, I think maybe they got bored of him, I'm not sure, but they've been a lot tougher on him than he is used to. I want to show you a clip of an interview with ITV. It was a post-speech interview with ITV. Let's take a look.
We went to Lee this morning, a seat Labour held for many years, lost at the last election. We asked voters what they think of you and what you've done so far. This is what they had to say about your leadership so far.
He's actually quite a weak personality, and I don't think he's as strong as he made out to be in what his beliefs are.
I'm not really a fan of how they seem to have put lots of negativity across and yet don't seem to have a solution.
Andy Burman, I think he is perfect. I think he's hardworking, I think he's honest, and I think he could really do the job.
I still vote for Grundy, yeah. I mean, my dad would turn his grave for me, honestly, because he went to the pits.
So there's a former Labour voter who voted Tory and will vote Tory again. I mean, what do you make of that? That was a fair reflection of what we found, Sakir.
Well, Andy Burnham will be happy about that. There's no doubt about that. But look, we lost really badly in 2019. Lee, I went to Lee just a week after the election in December 2019 to talk to communities there, to talk to people on the ground. And there is no doubt that people who had voted Labour for many years were not voting Labour anymore. And in Lee, we need to persuade them to vote Labour again.
You're not doing enough.
What I said in my conference speech in Doncaster in September was, Labour is under new leadership. Take another look. But I've never pretended that this was a one-year exercise. It's a four-year exercise. And I'm very pleased that people are now, that you're challenging me now about whether we're going to form the next government. I want that challenge. I'm up for that challenge. This morning's speech is part of answering the question, where do we go next as a country?
So it was an awkward question that I think was dealt with quite well. But Dahlia, I want your thoughts on this, because that was quite harsh, right? You've got a politician up there. It's their big day. And you show them an iPad with people saying they don't stand for much. And also they prefer Andy Burnham.
I just saw, like, if you watch it closely, you see Keir Starmer's soul leave his body when that guy's like, I love Andy Burnham. And Keir Starmer's just like, so funny. But yeah, I mean, many of us, I think this is really an interesting and quite an affirming turn of events in terms of like what a lot of our analysis of the Corbyn moment and kind of the aftermath of that, which is that, you know, we made the argument that someone with Corbyn's politics would never get into power if your path to power relies on the active support of the media. Now, that doesn't mean that you actively give the media things like clubs to beat you with, but that you can't rely on, you know, the mainstream British media to put you in power, okay? Turns out that it's not even just for those with Corbyn's politics. It's just for Labour leaders. And it reminds me of something that the late David Graeber said, which is that the kind of the character of the British state and the character of the people who, you know, are often reared in the same institutions as people who go on to be British politicians, often reared in the same institutions that go on to, you know, become editors in massive newspapers and broadcast media, the character of those institutions are inherently conservative. They cross over very much with the Conservative Party in quite a systematic way. And, you know, essentially, Starmer had a brief honeymoon period with the press by virtue of being a human being that wasn't Jeremy Corbyn. But that now subsided with the help of Keir Starmer. Now that Corbynism and its surrounding kind of movements, I guess, or kind of like its membership, etc., now that Corbynism is no longer seen as a threat, the media can go back to business as usual, which is the treatment that we saw under Gordon Brown, under Ed Miliband, of sort of belittling and delegitimizing the government, whatever they do, the Labour leadership, whatever they do, even though, you know, they are kind of right in their assessment here, which is that it was a bit of a nothing speech and it's really unclear what Labour's target constituency is outside of Guardian columnists, so that they haven't done a good job of holding the government to account at a time when it should be really, really easy. But it also, to me, reaffirms the analysis of Starmer's strategy of sort of reinforcing the basic ideology of the Conservatives, but just critiquing how that ideology is executed, is so wrongheaded, because it just means that, you know, when you have an inherently conservative media and an inherently conservative establishment, why would they go for the imitation when the original is right there? Why would they go for Tory light when they can just sell the Tories? And it also creates a context where Starmer has foreclosed building alternative paths to power that without needing relentlessly positive media from the coverage from the media, because he's broken that trust with activist bases and with the membership. So I think it's really interesting and probably quite a shock to the system that Keir Starmer thought if he sufficiently threw Corbyn under the bus, he'd be kind of wrapped up in cotton wool a little bit. But we know that the media have been doing this to Labour leaders for a very long time, while Jeremy Corbyn was still a backbencher that no one had really heard of.
Jeremy Corbyn had worse weeks with the media than Keir Starmer has had over the last 2 weeks. But there is something lacking with Keir Starmer, which is that no one can be bothered to defend him. He doesn't seem to have really any outriders. James, I want your thoughts on this. There's sort of two streams of thought when it comes to the wobble that Keir Starmer has had with the press. One is that this is all white noise, actually, where it matters, which is, you know, the general impression you've given the general public. Keir Starmer hasn't done that bad. And if there's a few negative comment pieces in the Times and the Telegraph and the Guardian, it just doesn't matter. It's completely irrelevant. And the other is that actually the reason, you know, the media smell blood is because they notice that you have got a media who doesn't know what he stands for and doesn't really have a project or a coalition behind him. What do you think we're witnessing here?
God, I mean, I think Dali is right, is that there's a large extent where there's a sort of automatic mechanism in the British press where you kind of go off and bash the Labour leaders. You're seeing it with Ed Miliband, you saw it with Gordon Brown. Tony Blair was a rare exception to this rule, at least for his first few years. I mean, eventually he started getting this as well. So that's just how the thing plays out. That's kind of kicked back into place, and there's not very much you can do about it. Starmer's problem is exactly as you said, is that he doesn't have a sort of automatic base. He doesn't have a reference point. He doesn't have a set of people who immediately come out and defend him in whatever form they can, which obviously Jeremy Corbyn had, Brown had, Ed Miliband had. You know, these things were there. Miliband less so, but it was there. So he's kind of exposed at this point. And I think there's also this problem. There's a sort of deeper issue, which is the one of dealing with the situation of the pandemic, is that they kind of, the strategy that they had was basically premised on this being over fairly rapidly, that you'll kind of be constructive opposition, everything will go back to normal, and then you're back into a normal routine. And in fact, we've got into this, it's now going to be a long drawn out period of quite odd circumstances with the vaccine rollout, with lockdowns easing, this sort of thing. It's going to be peculiar. And you've got a government that's adapting quite rapidly to that, because it's talking about the endemic recovery program. It's talking about long-term planning, green investment, all this sort of thing. So it's occupied lots of space over here. And I just don't think they have anything on this. They don't have any space to get to. So you're not presenting any real alternative to what the government's now doing. You're not dealing with the fact that the pandemic is kind of longer term than you anticipate, and it's shaping politics for that period of time.
I think Keir Starmer had a pre-agreed strategy with his team, which they were going to implement, which is we reassure the electorate, we say we're going to invest a bit more than the Conservatives, and then we get elected in 2024. The pandemic came along. They said, oh, that means we have to put this on pause. But then they did nothing for a year. Now they're implementing that same old strategy. You can't do that. You can't just say, oh, we're going to ignore the coronavirus and do what we were going to do anyway, which to me seems like what they've done, right?
Exactly. I don't think they've particularly laid out. As I said, I think they're sort of tackling George Osborne and dealing with the 2015 election, and we're two general elections away from that. By 2024, it's three. And the conditions of the 2024 election look to me like you will have a kind of red-green Toryism in some form, that levelling up will come to mean something, that they'll be talking up their environmental credentials to the skies. They've got COP26 in Glasgow this year, the big international, you know, climate change agreement. They're going to make this a centrepiece. The Tory government's going to make it a centrepiece of what he's doing. What does Labour have in that? What do we have in response when the Tories start saying a green industrial revolution? To me, you could do something around things like the Preston model, decentralisation, say instead of this centralising, control freak, basically fairly often fairly corrupt government, you're going to do something else. But they don't seem to want to do that. They want to attack some other different targets, and it's not the one they're up against.
All very good points. It's just my overwork. It's just a bit dull, isn't it? I mean, it was quite a boring speech. James Meadway, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Enjoy the rest of your Friday evening.
Thank you, and you.
Are Uber drivers self-employed contractors providing the cab hailing company with a service, or are they workers employed by Uber? Uber have always insisted the former, meaning the multinational accepted no obligations to pay for holidays, to pay the minimum wage, or to provide for drivers' pensions. Today, Britain's Supreme Court disagreed. Now, the Supreme Court delivered a unanimous verdict, reaffirming a decision made by three lower courts that Uber drivers could not be classed as self-employed contractors, that they were workers for Uber, and so were entitled to the rights that workers are entitled to. Explaining the ruling, Lord George Leggatt, who sits on the court, said drivers are in a position of subordination and dependency in relation to Uber such that they have little or no ability to improve their economic position through professional or entrepreneurial skills. So saying if it looks like a worker, if it sounds like a worker, you should treat the person like a worker. They are therefore not to be considered as independent contractors. Also, and this is very significant actually, and the Supreme Court ruled that Uber drivers are working whenever they are logged into the app, not just when they are driving. Uber had expressed that if they were classed as workers, they'd be only workers when they're driving. The Supreme Court have now quashed that delusion as well. Let's take a look at drivers celebrating outside the court.
The Supreme Court unanimously dismisses Uber's appeal.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Yes! Whether or not an individual is a worker within the meaning and intent of the relevant.
The right people are celebrating. Long story short, this is a big win for workers, a big loss for multinational corporations.
It's really difficult, actually, to overstate how much of an indictment this ruling of Uber's model against Uber's model is. You know, not only is there clarification that drivers are workers, but much of an Uber's inherent model was critiqued by the judgment. As you mentioned, you know, the fact that Uber does not count a driver being plugged into the app as working time, even though that is what a lot of drivers' working time is spent doing. And also that Uber doesn't get to decide whether or not employment law applies to their workers. And this is going to be, this is a really big blow to Uber's model. And it's something that's going to have reverberations across many different labor sectors, because obviously Uber is met as a lot of the time sort of seen as the poster boy for this kind of, or the poster company for the gig economy. But the techniques of, you know, worker misclassification is something that is common across a lot of different sectors. It's growing in a lot of different sectors, from childcare work, domestic work, sex work, courier work. There's so many inherent and fundamental processes of running our city that is essentially being outsourced to these particular kinds of companies that use these mechanisms like worker misclassification in order to save massive labor costs, in order to distance themselves from responsibility for the conditions that their business model creates on the ground, and also as a way of sort of shifting the burden and shifting the functioning costs of the business model onto the driver and onto the worker. So not only is this a really significant blow for Uber, but it is something that can potentially be taken up by workers across many different labor sectors where exploitation and precarity has taken on this particular form that was pioneered by Uber, but is spreading throughout the workforce.
What's your understanding of what the consequences of this ruling are going to be, you know, in the medium or long term? I mean, presumably this will mean that prices go up a bit, which, I mean, from my perspective, is a price worth paying for people having decent workers' rights. But is there also, you know, is there any argument from the driver's side that actually, no, we don't want to be classified as workers and we prefer being self-employed contractors? Is there two sides to this from the driver's perspective?
To the question of what are the consequences going to be, I think, you know, we're going to have to see. You know, Uber has lost this case, not only in UK courts multiple times, but also the Supreme Court of other countries like France have also handed down similar rulings. Obviously, this one in this context is different to the other ones handed down in the UK because Uber can't appeal because it's the Supreme Court. But it's going to be very interesting to see how Uber tries to wriggle out of it and how Uber tries, you know, it's a company that's very innovative in how it sort of can unfold exploitation. It's already been sending emails out to its workers saying, you know, business is going to continue as usual. This is a ruling that just applies to like a select number of workers who worked for the app in 2016. But, you know, the company's changed since then so that the ruling no longer applies. So in that sense, it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds. In terms of kind of potential drawbacks for drivers, well, I think this whole question of, you know, flexibility, which is often Uber's response to say that drivers want flexibility. And that's true, you know, workers do want flexibility. But in this context, flexibility is very much of a red herring. It's you know, first of all, flexibility does not need to be incompatible with basic workers' rights. It doesn't need to be incompatible with, you know, having a working at a minimum wage, of not shouldering the burden of operational costs, of having, you know, support and means to support yourself if you fall ill or if you start a family or, you know, when you become old. But the so-called flexibility in Uber's model lies primarily in the fact the only element of flexibility is that the driver can decide whether when they log in or out of the app. But drivers can't set their pay and conditions. They are managed and disciplined by an algorithm whose workings are not transparent. And the mechanism of control by the algorithm is not only similar to a traditional employer, it actually exceeds the level of control that a traditional employer can have. And that is partly because Uber's not bound to basic employee rights. So for example, a driver can be cut off from their work, from their income source because of a few bad ratings. Well, in a traditional employee situation, there would be a process of fair dismissal. You would get suspension pay. You wouldn't just be kind of cut off. So in many ways, that kind of idea of flexibility is very much a red herring. It doesn't reflect genuine flexibility because for many of these drivers who end up earning minimum wage, below minimum wage, they are forced to work for hours and hours and hours, very long hours in a very difficult job and unsocial hours in order to make ends meet. And as for the question of rates going up, I think as you mentioned, you know, there is a thing of, you know, we can't say that people can't, that, you know, in order for people to get cheap services, we need to have, you know, a whole workforce that is underpaid and exploited. But I think there's a really important question here about why the platform economy and things like Uber and, you know, care.com have become such a necessary part of our cities and such a necessary part of our infrastructure. And it's because a lot of these services, you know, like public transportation, like childcare, like, or, you know, elderly care, these are all sectors that were cut to the bone by austerity. And in that context where good public sector jobs, as well as, you know, free or at least very, very cheap services provided by the state, being run by people who are employed in secure work, as that starts to dissipate because of austerity, then you have the rise of these sort of vulture-like companies that are able to make them to exploit that condition to basically say, well, you either pick between being able to have childcare for your kids when you need it, or, you know, you have to pick between workers being paid well. So really, obviously, there's a relationship here between the company and the worker, but there's also the question of the broader context of what are the broader economic conditions that create the context for Uber to make it this false binary, essentially. So whilst, you know, there is a point to be made that, you know, there's only so that the relationship is not just between Uber and the driver and that, you know, the consumer is implicated in a sense there, we have to look at why so many consumers are having to rely on the private provision by these exploitative companies for these basic services.
Because obviously, I suppose that was a competitive advantage that Uber had as well, which is that, you know, Transport for London had to pay people also pensions and sick pay, and then Uber could cut costs because they didn't have any of those obligations. So in a way, this levels the playing field. Straight on to our next story. The second phase of the Grenfell inquiry has restarted after being adjourned over January due to the coronavirus pandemic. And for the past 2 weeks, the investigation has heard evidence about Arconic, the multi-billion dollar multinational that supplied the cladding on Grenfell, which according to phase one of the inquiry was responsible for the speed at which the fire spread. Now, last week, the inquiry heard from Debbie French, who's the UK sales manager for Arconic. She told the inquiry that the company had been aware of high-rise fires caused by combustible cladding, but had decided not to withdraw their version of the product for, I quote, commercial reasons, i.e. it wouldn't have been quite so profitable. This week, the inquiry heard from Claude Schmidt, the president of Arconic Architectural Products, which is based in France. Now, he responded to evidence that Arconic had hidden evidence of fire tests, which showed that the cladding supplied to Grenfell had failed. Now, ITV News provided this overview of what happened this week.
This was the type of cladding used on the tower, Rainerbond PE. But this panel had failed a fire safety test. And in another email, an Arconic manager wrote that this must be kept very confidential.
Capital letters, very confidential, 4 exclamation marks.
When questioned by the inquiry, the Arconic boss admitted the company was being deliberately dishonest.
You accept that Arconic was deliberately and dishonestly misleading its customers about the claimed fire certification for cassette variant for Rainerbond 55PE.
Well, in any case, regarding the B classification, I mean, according to the Euro norm, yes.
But there are more emails. Another boss replies about the failed cladding test. This shouldn't have even been mentioned, he writes.
And it looks as if Arconic was simply keen to stop this information getting out. Do you accept that?
Oui.
Yes.
And yet another email. Here, a manager says that Arconic is not clean. And Mr. Schmidt admitted that his employee lied to a customer about fire safety.
Mr. Verley lied to him.
Really?
Yes.
So all, you know, incredibly shocking. Basically, you have a company which supplied the cladding, which we all saw go up in flames, which knew it was flammable, which had seen tests which showed that it was flammable, but hadn't told their customers that those tests existed. They'd basically made out this was safe when they knew it wasn't. Now, to find out more about this case and especially what's been said about Arconic over the past couple of weeks at this inquiry, I spoke to Peter Apps, who is deputy editor at Inside Housing.
The cladding is already established to be the primary cause of why the fire spread so rapidly. And what we heard this week was the details of that test you mentioned, where Arconic saw the fire risks of that cladding in a particular shape and continued to sell it anyway.
And what will be the consequences of this? Because, I mean, I think people witnessing this inquiry, they'll see this is so unjust. You know, there were people in this multinational corporation who were purposefully hiding information which would have saved people's lives if it had been made public. I mean, what are people hoping will be the consequences of this?
The Metropolitan Police have got an investigation running. That's well known. And after the inquiry is finished, then that investigation will take over. I don't know what the criminal consequences, if any, would be for Arconic, but the investigation is certainly looking at everyone involved. Arconic also have shareholders and a kind of major reputation globally, and I guess the survivors certainly and the bereaved have been trying to put pressure on them, on their reputation, to make sure that, you know, the market takes a note of the evidence that's come out over the last couple of weeks.
And could you talk a bit about the wider context of how this was able to happen? Because again, from my brief readings about this all, it seems like they basically, Arconic, had carte blanche to mislead people, to sort of say actually it's less flammable than it actually is. How was that allowed to happen? How could that happen?
I mean, I think one of the really important things to understand with the cladding and the insulation and the other products that are involved in the fire is that the testing information isn't public. It's owned by the company that does the test and makes the product, and it's basically up to them what they put out onto the market. And I mean, it's an even greater extent than that. It's usually quite a small number of people who are involved in the technical sides of these businesses that ever see those test reports. And so the story with Arconic, as it is with Kingspan and Celotex, is that these reports were just held within the business. So they were never pushed particularly hard to release them. They released the reports to the market that they chose to release. And it's only because of the inquiry and the investigation after the fire that these things have ever made it into the public domain.
Does this suggest negligence on the part of just the company, where you could call it negligence or you could call it gross misconduct or whatever? But is this also a problem that the clients didn't want to know? So is it a problem that the people, for example, who were contracted to refurbish Grenfell thought, we could ask some difficult questions, but to be honest, these guys are giving us a low cost, let's just run with it and not ask difficult questions? Is it the clients that are also at fault here?
I think what's certainly true is that around the world, there were enough cladding fires happening for someone, if they really wanted to look into this subject, to know that there was a risk associated with cladding materials. And like, there's so many different people involved in the refurbishment, like each one of them probably has to answer that question in slightly different ways. But I think people in the market generally and at Grenfell were pretty happy to take the cheapest product quite frequently without turning their mind too much to either what was safe or what was legal.
That was Peter Apps, who's been reporting from the Grenfell Inquiry and is deputy editor at Inside Housing. Obviously, that inquiry continues and we'll be hearing from different responsible bodies. So there's going to be the representatives from Kensington Council, from the people who are in charge of the building. At the moment, it's focused on the supply of those materials. Really, really appalling, actually, what's coming out of that inquiry. And I imagine it will continue on the same light. Such a catastrophe on so many different levels. Right, next story. The G7 met today for the first time since last April, the summer, which brought together the leaders of the US, UK, France, Japan, Canada, Italy, and Germany, was hosted by Boris Johnson and was the first to be attended by President Joe Biden. Vaccines dominated the agenda. The UK government, which has ordered 400 million doses of the vaccines, has said it will donate the majority of its surplus to the developing world via COVAX. That's the World Health Organization's vaccine program. But the UK wants to finish vaccinating its adult populations first. And the US has said a similar thing. The French President Macron has proposed an alternative plan. He's suggesting that the US and Europe should immediately commit to sending 5% of their vaccine supplies to the developing world. So not wait until all of their populations are vaccinated first. Both the US and the UK appear more keen to donate money to COVAX rather than donate vaccines directly. Joe Biden has pledged $2 billion for the scheme with a potential for $2 billion more. And at the close of that meeting this afternoon, it was announced that £5.3 billion was being pledged by G7 members to WHO COVID schemes. That money obviously is welcome, but will it go far enough to remedy the scarcity of vaccines in the global south? I just want to get up a graph to show the extent of that inequality here. So in North America, so the US and Canada, 10% of people have received a vaccine. In Europe, 5.9% of people. Obviously, that goes up to around 25% in the UK because our rollout has been pretty successful. You go down to Africa, 0.2% of the population have been vaccinated. Now, Oceania at the bottom there with none. That's not really because of global inequality. That's because they very successfully implemented a zero COVID policy, so are in no rush to roll those vaccines out. Now, to discuss the politics of vaccine distribution, I'm joined by Dorothy Guerrero, Head of Policy and Advocacy at Global Justice Now. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. So I wanted to start by asking you what you make of the pledges that came out of the G7 today. Is this money, this £5.3 billion, going to be a game changer in terms of access to vaccines for people in Africa and South America?
The pledge at the G7 online summit today to share or donate the majority of future surplus coronavirus vaccine with the COVAX vaccine sharing program of the World Health Organization to support developing countries is good. However, charity will not address the real problem of vaccine apartheid caused by two related things. And these two related things are: first, wealthier countries in the G7 bought up much more doses needed by their populations. We could vaccinate people here in the UK many times over, while those in the developing countries would need to wait before they can buy up the supplies because we bought them up in advance. And there's really a scarcity for the others. But then also, this scarcity is not natural, because at the same time, another problem here is that the same countries that stockpile on supplies are blocking the attempts of developing countries to increase the number of laboratories or companies that could manufacture more vaccines. That is through blocking the requests by countries led by India and South Africa at the World Trade Organization to waive certain intellectual property rights. So actually, this is the bigger problem.
At the moment, it seems like what people are very rightly, reasonably doing is sort of lobbying the Western governments to loosen the IP, the intellectual property rights on the Western vaccines. To what extent could it actually be countries not in the G7 that sort of come to the rescue, as it were, of the global south? So you've got Russia, who I think today announced that they are going to supply 3 million doses of the Sputnik vaccine to Africa. China, their vaccine doesn't seem to be quite as good, but I imagine they're going to swoop in and supply some vaccines as well. So Is there a chance that sort of what people are talking about as vaccine diplomacy, people trying to get influence by supplying vaccines, could ultimately really reduce the inequality here?
Yeah, actually, that's the big difference that we are seeing here. While the wealthy nations gave the power to big pharmas to control the price and to control where the supplies will go, both Russia and China are doing what they call vaccine diplomacy and sending their vaccines directly to Africa and other developing countries. Yesterday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said that just 10 countries have administered 75% of all COVID-19 vaccines, while more than 100 countries have not received a single dose. So the Russian and Chinese governments are more than willing than their Western counterparts to strike licensing deals to allow manufacturers in places like Indonesia, the United Arab Emirates, and Malaysia and other countries to partly or fully produce COVID-19 vaccines themselves. So according to a Guardian article yesterday, it says that China and Russia have supplied more than 800 million vaccine doses between them to 41 countries.
And that could be a difference between, say, for example, this crisis and the HIV crisis, whereas now you've actually got a sort of multipolar world where if the Americans and the British and the Europeans say, well, it's not our problem, then other people can swoop in. So, I mean, you can sort of see the benefit of having a multilateral and a multipolar system.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting that you mentioned the HIV vaccines because medicines. In 2000, there was that debate, actually, at the WTO on the same issue of the trade-related intellectual property rights, because at that time also the cure for HIV is monopolized by the big pharma. Mm-hmm. And India proved that when they produce generics, that brought the price of the vaccine down, and they were able to supply to South Africa and other developing countries. So that is the same rationale here. If the TRIPS, those related provisions in TRIPS can be waived, then more countries can increase the vaccine manufacturing capacity, because there are more factories, more laboratories can do them. And also, if I may add as well, if we would look at the case, for example, of Cuba, Cuba has been under a trade blockade for many decades. But despite that trade blockade, it was able to produce Soberania 2, which is now on the third phase of testing. And the Cuban government said that they can produce 100 million doses. Cuba only has 11 million population. So the remaining 70 million, they said they will give it to the ALBA countries, or the countries that are their partners, like Venezuela, Bolivia, and others. So if we can imagine that more countries can do this, because they already have the know-how. The fact that Serum Institute in India is being used by the Oxford Seneca to produce vaccines, so they already have the facilities, they already have the scientists that can do this.
Dorothy Guerrero, thank you so much for joining us this evening and giving us your insight.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Dorothy Guerrero from Global Justice Now. If you want to know more actually about the struggles that involved the fight for generics during the HIV and AIDS crisis, not that it's ended, but I mean, it was much, much worse when there wasn't access to generic drugs, which thankfully in many more places there are now. I do recommend the film Fire in the Blood on Netflix. I watched it a couple of weeks ago. Very, very instructive at this moment in time. Throughout this third lockdown, just like the second and the first, the British public have been very good at following the rules. It's why since the start of this lockdown, daily cases have plummeted from 60,000 a day to 12,000. However, Britain still has the highest death toll in Europe, and so the government needs someone to blame. It's why we keep seeing increasingly hysterical public information adverts making out the public to be the real villain of this pandemic. On that front, this is the latest output from the Home Office. We can take a look at this now. We've unfortunately had to take the sound off because YouTube sort of has these automatic systems, which mean that if we played the blaring drum and bass, which is in the background to this Home Office video, it might get taken down. But for now, you can see it's quite bold. You shouldn't make your own pub. It's playing really, I think, an advert we saw quite in the 90s and the noughties, which were respectively telling you not to download videos because you wouldn't steal a video from the shop, so you shouldn't download them. But here you can say, you shouldn't have baby showers. You shouldn't be meeting up. And meeting up is against the law. And this is, you know, better if you have that aggressive drum and bass in the background. Dahlia, we've spoken a few times on this show, actually, about the public health adverts we've seen from the government. I think this is probably my favourite one so far. What did you make of it?
I mean, 90s nostalgia is about, like, belly tops and Destiny's Child. It's not about, like, these corny, although I do kind of, it did make me feel nostalgic despite my best efforts, but still, like, these campaigns by the government are just so relentlessly patronizing and annoying and just miss the point. Because, you know, as we mentioned, when we talked about that poster campaign a few weeks ago, where it was, you know, pictures of people on ventilators with the slogan being like, you know, look him in the eyes and tell him that you need to, that you can't work from home, for example. And I just reiterate what I said when we talked about that poster campaign, which is that these guilt tripping and, you know, harrowing punitive poster campaigns and campaigns in general shouldn't be directed to people who have had unclear messaging, have had irresponsible lockdown policy, who are being forced to go into work and therefore get on the tube, etc. They should be directed to MPs and bosses who have created the conditions for us to still not have this virus under control or not find a way to have this virus without it killing so many people. These videos should be that you shouldn't tell people to take a deadly virus on the chin. You shouldn't open restaurants and cafes and shops when it will cause thousands and thousands of people to die over Christmas just to help, you know, companies make their Christmas bottom line. You know, you shouldn't tell people that they need to self-isolate when they have symptoms, when you don't provide, especially self-employed people, the means to do that. And you also shouldn't tell people to not go into work unless it's absolutely necessary, but then give their bosses the jurisdiction to decide if it's necessary or not. And it's also this other way of responding to the crisis and responding to this pandemic, which is essentially a crisis of care in many ways, and say that instead of revamping those infrastructures of care and understanding how to rebuild them in a way that enables people to take decisions and take action that is in the interest of the public health, you instead say, we're just going to respond with like policing and punitive and hyper individualized and get people to blame one another. It not only deflects from your own failings as, you know, the institutions whose role and responsibility it is to make sure that we have a coordinated response and one that is informed by the science. But it also helps to, again, retrench this conservative ideology that the way that we deal with crisis is to blame people next to us, to blame people who are more vulnerable than us, and to just turn to systems of punishment and policing.
It's quite simple, really, isn't it? Does having a baby shower or a house party in the middle of a pandemic help spread it? Yes. Is that the reason why we have the highest death toll in Europe? Absolutely not. People have been, on the whole, very, very, very strict in terms of following the rules. The reason we have an incredibly high death toll is all of the reasons Dahlia has just said there. We go into lockdowns very, very late. We haven't paid people to self-isolate for the past year. You know, these are really simple things that the government has refused to do. And they are the failings that we point out regularly on this show. If you do want to watch more Novara Media, please do subscribe to the channel. We go live every Monday, Wednesday and Friday at 7 p.m. and put out videos every day. Now, I've said the government is using parties to distract from their own failures. That's absolutely true. It also doesn't mean none are happening. Last Halloween, police struggled to break up a rave of between 500 and 700 people in Yate, which is outside Bristol. Now, one of those in attendance was 18-year-old George Parsons, who, along with five others, received a £200 fine from a Bristol magistrate last week. According to the prosecutor, and I quote, police attended at 2 p.m. on November the 1st. By that time, there were between 30 and 50 people remaining. They were ordered to disperse. All the defendants refused to leave. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Seems like a fairly minor case. I mean, it is a fairly minor case, but it did spawn this fairly entertaining video. This is George Parsons leaving court last week. It's gone viral.
Do you have anything to say about the offence?
Raves aren't anti-lockdown, they're anti-capitalism.
And, you know, the threat of spreading the virus.
Fear is a guarantee of control. People are affected by the modern way of life, whether there's raves on or not.
So if someone became seriously ill as a result?
I've had so many of my friends seriously ill through modern way of life, and so the raves are a way to respect them.
Raves aren't anti-lockdown, they're anti-capitalism. Then asked about the threat of spreading the virus, he says fear is the currency of control. Now, I want to be clear before we talk about this, because he seems like a nice kid. He actually reminds me of people I knew when I was 18. So I don't want to be sort of like, you know, joining this pile and to say that the pandemic is his fault. The pandemic is clearly not his fault. But some of those, I mean, the points are bullshit, really. And some of them are kind of interesting. Darling, I want to bring you in on, I suppose that there is this sort of strain of like rave culture, which again, I do have a lot of like warmth towards, but has brought into a funny politics around this pandemic, which, I mean, first of all, are raves really anti-capitalist? And two, I mean, fear is the current, we're not just, all of the warnings that we get about spreading the virus aren't just to control us. You know, it's because literally this is really dangerous. what did you make of that clip?
I mean, I don't have time for this argument because we all know, we all have those comrades that like this kind of shtick. I don't have time for that outside of a pandemic, let alone in a pandemic. You know, raves aren't anti-capitalist. They're especially not anti-capitalist when they're happening in the middle of an airborne virus disease pandemic. You know, we don't throw people, especially people who are more vulnerable than us, workers, their lives and livelihoods under the bus for raves. So let me just clarify that. But also, like, as you mentioned, like, he's a kid. He's doing what kids do. And like, the thing is, and the thing that you mentioned as well is that, yeah, there are some people who break the rules. There are some people who are still having parties, da 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 da. That's true in every country. There are always going to be people who are going to be like, who are just going to, you know, feel invincible. They tend to be younger men who just feel like they're, you know, they can just like, they're invincible and their health is like forever. And, you know, but that exists in every country. That's clearly not the reason we have the death toll that we have. But I also do have PTSD from this video just because I sometimes have to spend time with this nonsense, like, in general. And I'm just like, no. And also, I mean, he's an 18-year-old kid. I know bloody 50-year-old adults with, like, full jobs who make this exact same argument. And I'm just like, oh.
So George Parsons, if you're watching, slap on the wrist for going to that rave. Also, you know, raves are anti-lockdown, sorry. They're not particularly anti-capitalist. But we know who our enemy is. It's not you. It's Boris Johnson and all of those bosses who are forcing their workers to go into the office, even though we're in the middle of a pandemic and they could quite easily work from home. James O'Brien is LBC's star presenter, and he likes to put himself forward as a voice of reason, avoiding tribal politics to simply get to the truth. In reality, he can be a bit of a bully, with no interest in any evidence that conflicts with his prior beliefs. Let's take a look at a conversation he had with a caller in a phone-in about Keir Starmer's speech.
Listen to the speech. I really tried to keep myself listening to it because it was so dull. But the points he made...
Dull in delivery.
Yes, but that could have been a speech made by Jeremy Corbyn with sincerity. There was no sincerity in it.
Right.
It was just what people... He thought what people wants to hear.
Right.
No sincerity at all.
Okay.
And I'm a lifelong socialist, and I wouldn't vote for him.
No. Well, there's a surprise, Ian.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I bet he had a really open mind before he started speaking.
Well, he's had... All he's done is attack members of the Labour Party.
Yeah, all right, mate. Have a great day. Yeah, let's keep on fighting among each other, Ian, because that will really stick it to the Tories. Am I right or am I right, brother?
That's what he's been doing.
Come on, comrade, let's keep fighting. Let's go after him, because that will really teach Boris Johnson a lesson. Come on, comrade Ian, tell me again how awful Keir Starmer is.
Well, he could have pulled up the government on points without being opportunistic.
Right, an example of that?
Well, example is with the terrible treatment of businesses who were stiff by insurers over business insurance.
And how can he, with 4 years until he gets into government, use that as a political leverage?
He could have publicised it.
Right.
He could be.
How do you know about it?
Transport workers.
How do you know about it?
How do I know about it? Because I've been following the story in the financial press.
So it's been publicised?
He hasn't stood up and championed the small guy against the big guy.
Well, down with Labour, says our pocket socialist Ian, mate. Good luck. Shall we do a quick rousing chorus of the red flag before we jog on?
Now, that was really unpleasant to watch, wasn't it? And also, I mean, he really wasn't listening. James O'Brien wasn't listening to the caller because he's saying, what is Keir Starmer not raising that you'd like him to raise? The caller gives a decent example and he says, well, if you read it in the financial press, that means it's already being heard about. So why would he need to say it? Because it's already in the financial press. I mean, this guy's supposed to be smart. What kind of argument is that? I mean, more fundamentally, though, if Keir Starmer loses in 2024, or if he has to resign before then, it's going to be because of attitudes like that. It's going to be people who spent the previous 5 years having no curiosity whatsoever as to why Jeremy Corbyn managed to get 40% in 2017. No curiosity whatsoever as about why hundreds of thousand people joined a political party for someone who they thought was an idiot. And they still have no curiosity. They think because he lost an election in 2019, they can forget everything that happened between 2015 and now. And that person who called there, yes, I mean, I don't know how big a percentage of the population are that committed to socialism and the Labour Party, but the points he's raising aren't alien. The points he's raising are beliefs which are held by huge swathes of people in this country who James O'Brien thinks he can just tell to fuck off, essentially, you know? I mean, obviously, there's the hypocrisy here as well. James O'Brien is there saying like, oh, of course, you're complaining about Keir Starmer. You're just helping the Tories. James O'Brien, who spent the previous 5 years using his enormous platform to say that Jeremy Corbyn is the worst person ever. And also they should adopt this policy, a second referendum, which doesn't really help them to win an election. And it lost them swathes of seats. And now he's there getting on his high horse, telling anyone who dares critique Keir Starmer now that they're just helping the left lose. Dahlia, I wanted to bring you in. What did you think watching that?
Yeah, I mean, that was really gross. I remain confused as to what the purpose of LBC is. Like, they hate their listeners, unless they're touting great replacement conspiracy theories, of course, as we sort of talked about a few shows ago. But there's so many ironic points in there, and not just the ones that you raised, but, you know, James O'Brien's he's telling this listener off because what he's basically trying to say is, you know, obviously didn't have an open mind, like because you like Jeremy Corbyn or because you're a socialist. So there's nothing that Starmer could do that would, that you would like, that you just hate him. And, you know, that's going to divide the Labour Party. And, that means that we're not, you know, that means that they're not going to be able to beat the Tories. Sorry, but the splitting of the Labour Party right now is not coming from the left. The splitting of the Labour Party is coming from a leadership that is suspending activists, suspending long-term members, cracking down on local democracy, a leadership that is doing absolutely everything that it possibly can to tell young people and socialists in the party that they are in no way welcome in the party. And he says, you know, socialists have this closed mind with Keir Starmer. They wouldn't even give him a chance. Sorry, but socialists actually elected Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer would not have won with the mandate that he won with the membership if socialist members were not also voting for him. A lot of people made that concession because they felt that, you know, and because he in many ways misled people to believe that he would continue that legacy of socialism, but in a way that was perhaps more palatable than Jeremy Corbyn. I never held that position, but I think a lot of people did. And that is why he was able to become leader of the Labour Party. And a lot of those people are now angry because they feel like their vote was stolen, because not only is Keir Starmer not a socialist, but he's actually using his platform to crack down on and suppress and marginalize and push socialists who have always been part of the Labour Party out of the party. And he also said another thing where he said, oh, you know, how can Keir Starmer do anything about, you know, Johnson failing on the thing that the listener raised when he's, you know, four years away from power? Like, what do you expect him to do? And obviously, you know, the listener gave a good example of, well, he can campaign about it. He can put pressure about it. He's the leader of the opposition. Well, not only has Keir Starmer actively said that he has no intention to challenge the government on its fundamental approach and fundamental response to the pandemic and refuse to support teachers and et cetera in their fight to, you know, have secure and safe working conditions, but there's actually a lot that you can do from opposition. The furlough scheme at the beginning of the pandemic was in part a concession on the basis of John McDonnell acting in solidarity with trade unions and workers who are calling for a furlough scheme. That's the same case for the expansion of the furlough scheme to self-employed workers, which the original version of the package didn't include. That was done by the solidarity and the joining of forces by civil society, by campaign groups, and the leader of the opposition. Marcus Rashford did it, and he's not even a politician. So you can actually achieve quite a bit by putting on pressure, especially when this government has done so many objectionable things. You can actually have quite a bit of impact if you have that solidarity with civil society, with workers, and you have a vision that you're able to stick to. And that's the thing that Starmer's missing.
And it's also not going to do him any harm. I mean, that's what's so frustrating about it. There's exactly. So many fights he could have now, which wouldn't lose a single voter. Is there anyone, you know, just to take the example that caller had, is there anyone who's going to think, oh, he stood up for small businesses against insurers, so I'm not going to vote for him? You know, that's exactly. Just not a vote loser.
It would build a base. It would create a sense of trust. And also the thing that he was saying, the thing that the caller was saying, which is, you know, he's not sincere, he's not, you know, strong, he's not taking, that's the exact same thing that we saw at the beginning of the show that was being said by that Vox, that, you know, that was in that Vox Pop video with people in Lee. So it's not just this like fringe, like socialist, like people who are just really obsessed with Jeremy Corbyn. It's actually a lot of the consensus is that Keir Starmer is failing to show a vision and that he seems to, you know, speak out of both sides of his mouth.
Talia Gabriel. It's been such a pleasure speaking through today's news with you this evening. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you so much. I feel better now. I was really tired at the beginning of the show, and now I've had a little boost of adrenaline.
And thank you, everyone, for watching the show. I hope we've perked you up as well. Thank you, as ever, for your super chats tonight. We'll be back on Monday at 7 p.m. For now, have a great weekend. You've been watching Tisky Sour on Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.